Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and chat to us. We at Label Sessions sort of know you as an innovation director, someone who's into lean innovation. I'd love for you to share an intro with us to you, a little bit about you, your work, and the backstory that gets you to where you are today.
Sure. It's a bit of a wiggly career, I suppose. I studied law at uni. And I quickly realized I didn't want to be a lawyer, but I saw it through. And then when I graduated, I joined the management training scheme at L'Oreal. So I was in beauty, hair care, skincare for quite a few years. And that was at the time when digital was just starting to take off. So it was MySpace, it was Second Life, this was before YouTube, Facebook was just starting. So I was sort of at that point in my career, I sort of was at a fork in the road where it was, do I go into brand management or do I specialize in digital and all things new? And it felt right that I went in the digital direction. So a bit of FMCG and a bit of B2B and a bit of B2B2C, and learned a lot in an amazing international company. And then when it was time to move, I wanted to try something else. So I worked in the third sector for a breast cancer charity for a bit. And again, it was all about transformation. So helping them go from essentially an offline organization to an omnichannel organization. So I did that for a bit. And then I went back into beauty. So I was asked to join the founding team of a makeup company called Charlotte Tilbury Beauty. You've probably heard of it because about 7 years after that, they exited with a valuation of €1 billion, I think. So that was my unicorn experience, I suppose. And I was responsible for everything digital. So from building and establishing the founder's personal brand online, creating content, but the whole, the most important thing for me was to overcome the barriers that exist existed in terms of being able to sell beauty and color online. So how do you become a truly digital first beauty company? And I think we did it. And everything through the e-commerce platform to the sort of the whole customer experience, I suppose, was my baby. So we did that. And then after that, I moved onto the agency side, and I was an agency strategist, leading professional services for a digital agency, or a full service agency, actually. And when I joined the agency, I suppose they had a bit of a strategic gap. And by the time I left, it was an agency that was all about solving problems for customers. And it was over that period of time when I really sort of developed this ethos about falling in love with the problem, not the solution. And I think that's probably the most important thing that I've kept with me, that quite often people will come to you and say, I need an app, I need a widget, I need whatever it happens to be. And more often than not, they don't. More often than not, they think they need the thing. But it's always worth just winding it backwards a little bit and understanding what is the actual problem that you tried to solve for you, the customer, the partner, the client, whoever it happens to be. And so that was very much my ethos when I was on the agency side. Then I moved to BT, where I was running an setting up, building, developing, running an innovation team. And the remit of my team there was to explore, to validate, to build and to grow new products and businesses that were adjacent to BT's core business. And typically they would involve data and AI. And when I joined, there wasn't much structure or framework for doing this kind of innovation work. There weren't that many people doing it. And so what I did was I worked with Eric Ries's Lean Startup Company for about 6 months, and we developed our own framework and set of processes and culture and behaviors for lean innovation in a corporate. And we called it RapidWorks, and I still call it RapidWorks, and that's what I still do today, except I don't do it at BT. So doing it independently. But, you know, so much of the work that we did was about changing the culture and changing the behaviors that are most conducive to doing brilliant innovation. So if you think about most startups, well, 95% of startups, let's say, fail for one reason or another. And then if you think about the corporate landscape, you typically make 100 slides in a PowerPoint and you come up with the big idea and you really believe in the idea and you sell the idea to everyone. And then you unlock some funding, you get the funding, and then you have to make the idea a success. Whether or not it is going to be a success, you have to make it a success. It's tied to your personal performance. It's tied to the fact that you've made a whole load of big promises about what you can do with the funding that you've been given. And so there's this sort of moonshot culture where there are a few big bets and a lot of people's professional success is tied to those. And what it can lead to is essentially throwing good money after bad when all the evidence is telling you that this isn't a goer and you still keep going at it. And I think there's a corporate arrogance to that. You know, why should those corporate ideas be any better than the startups, 95% of which are failing? And so what we tried to do is create more of a startup mentality, but one that was very finely tuned to the realities of working in a corporate. You know, you can't pretend you're a startup because you're not. You work for a massive, massive company. And there's all the things that make innovation hard in a massive company, like people's biases and their opinions and the corporate red tape and governance and lack of pace, all this kind of thing. But if you can create a culture where it's okay to make a stop decision, where you celebrate stop decisions and celebrate validated learning, even if the learning is we shouldn't pursue this one thing. So over the space of 12 months or 18 months, we probably explored 30 different opportunities in my team of 8 or 10. And we killed, 25 of them. Because the evidence told us that either there wasn't a customer with a problem worth solving, or there wasn't a solution worth offering to the customer, or it wasn't one that would add value to the customer, or it wasn't one that we could grow and scale. And that, you know, that's so much of that is about the culture, but obviously there's a need for a robust process to underpin all of that, and governance to underpin it. So yeah, we've been doing that at BT for 18, 20 months. And then I'm now doing it independently. So consulting with big companies. So, you know, we're working a lot in insurance at the moment, but also in the legal sector. We've got quite a lot of expertise in ESG, in social value. We've worked with Royal Mail. We've worked with the University of Cambridge. We've worked with De Beers. We do a lot with Lloyd's of London, who are very entrepreneurial and have a very innovative mindset. But yeah, it's I love it. I wouldn't want to do anything else, because you're always taking people on a journey and you're always taking them in a positive direction. The work we do is objectively about making decisions that are underpinned by data, and the sort of, and they're also about taking something, innovation, which people think is inherently risky, and helping those people and those organizations understand and create processes to mitigate that risk, to make it something that's the opposite of risky. So yeah, that's a whistle stop tour of my wiggly career to date.
No, that's brilliant. There's tons to unpack there, because you've done so much. And you've already answered my next question, which was, what is it that you're keeping you busy right now? But I think something that is a good sort of tie on from that is, obviously you did RapidWorks as a part of BT, and now you've sort of gone independent with it. How has your day to day, or how has your sort of operations changed going independent versus being part of a brand, for lack of a better term? And is there, like, does it come with its own set of challenges, or is it more freeing in general?
I suppose the main difference is that in my life at BT, we had two sort of areas of business. One was developing our own products, or exploring, killing, pursuing, pivoting our own products. And we, you know, we had a busy funnel of, you know, plenty in the sort of in the ideas hopper at any one time. But, you know, we would easily have 6, 7, 8 opportunities in at different stages of the funnel at any one time. So that was the bulk, like, that was our official remit, I would say. But then we would do a huge amount of facilitation and workshops and sort of delivering boot camps for colleagues who are really interested in exploring more innovative and entrepreneurial way of working, but also for customers. So, you know, we were basically constantly hunting for problems. Everyone's got a problem. You know, everyone's got something that if they could wave a magic wand and fix, they would, or a problem that's keeping them awake at night, or that kind of thing. So we were constantly on the hunt for them. And as part of doing that, we would deliver workshops and facilitate different sessions for different customers. And so on one hand, we were doing the business, and on the other hand, we were helping other people sort of drink the Kool-Aid that, you know, we really believe in. And I suppose, to answer your question, the way my day-to-day is different is that now I'm entirely doing the latter. You know, I'm not exploring any of my own entrepreneurial opportunities at the moment. I'm helping organizations become more entrepreneurial. So that's the main shift. I mean, obviously, there's the fact that I don't have a regular paycheck coming in. You know, like, the comfort of being in a corporate is very significant, but the freedom of not being in one is significant as well.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's very much a, I don't want to say a double-edged sword, but it's very much it's its own set of challenges and sort of, you know, benefits. I'd love to talk a little bit about what it is that excites you right now in the field that you're in terms of, like, innovation and innovation direction. And do you think that there's any sort of opportunities emerging, especially as independent now, or challenges that will be important for the work that you do, obviously, with so many clients?
Yeah, I think the biggest trend that I've been seeing for at least a year now is the obsession with AI. And, you know, so many, every innovation conference is about AI. Every, you know, so many conversations I have with clients and potential clients is about AI, or what should we be doing with AI? And the most, what is exciting for me about that is, you shouldn't be doing anything with AI. You should be trying to understand what is the problem that you're trying to solve. So for a number of sectors, the problem they're trying to solve does relate to AI, in the sense that the legal industry is trying to get to grips of how they're going to tackle this thing. You know, it has huge ramifications for the work they do. The same for insurance. You know, the things that need to be insured that pertain to AI are, you know, there's loads of them. But the fact is, AI isn't a sort of problem or a solution in itself. AI is a means to solving a problem that you as an organization or as an individual need to identify. It's a bit, you know, like 10 years ago, people weren't saying, oh, what should we be doing with PHP or JavaScript, you know? But, you know, so AI is just a, it's a toolkit for doing amazing, you know, world-changing things. But it's not, I don't believe it's the starting point. So much, and as humans, we are solution focused. You know, we sort of hone in on solutions. And one of the most important parts of my job is helping clients understand their problems before they start thinking about the solutions. And it sounds straightforward, but it really isn't, because we're so hardwired to think about solutions. And that, I think, is why this preoccupation with AI is so pervasive.
No, it's a really healthy aspect or way to look at it, because it's like you say, people are very solution focused, and it's very easy to just be like, well, this is this new burgeoning thing, we'll just throw it at it and hopefully it'll be the solution for us. But I'd love to, obviously AI is burgeoning in so many fields right now, everybody's, like I said, just trying to throw it out and see what sticks. But what's the conversation that you think people should be having in your field instead of AI? Because obviously AI is all-encompassing, everybody's talking about it.
Just to be clear, I'm not saying they shouldn't be talking
about it. No, yeah, but it's just like, it's just a different perspective.
I've been running teams for ages who've been using AI, but we've been using AI to improve our efficiency. You know, why spend a whole day writing a document when you can get an AI to have a first pass at it? Do it do it in 20 minutes. And so many organizations can be looking at, you know, existing solutions that use AI to improve their operations. And by making your operations more efficient, you're freeing up the time to be more innovative, either with or without AI, rather than having to do it on the side of your desk, because you're so busy essentially doing your day job. The things that I would say, if I understand your question, that I think that clients can and should be focusing on. Well, there's two things that are sort of a bit of a drumbeat that run through all the conversations I have, which is the ability to distinguish between things you know and things you think you know. So challenging assumptions, you know, so much failure in entrepreneurship or doing new things is based on essentially building your house on unstable foundations. And those unstable foundations are things that you thought were true, which turn out not to be true. So that's the first thing, is the difference between things we know and things we think we know. And then the second is starting to understand the difference between things that are important and things that are important now. Just because something is important doesn't mean you need to do it immediately. There will always be something that is more important to address now. And so it's about mitigating the biggest risks in the correct order, so you don't throw too much money, energy, time at the exciting new thing that you really believe in.
Yeah, no. The intent of that question wasn't to be dismissive of AI. It was just a case of finding, because obviously, you know, it's finding the right solution for it and finding the right use for it is the most important thing. And obviously it's not a one size fits all sort of solution. But I was just wanting to think a bit now of, you know, the industries that you work in, you must have so many different sort of caps on with different orbits of clients and how they push innovation. And what questions do you think leaders should be asking themselves right now and the shifts that they would have to make?
Leaders, to do innovation well in a big corporate requires the executive sponsorship. So those leaders need to be fully, fully bought in to the fact of how this stuff works. So if you're running an innovation team, you're very unlikely to be delivering revenue this year or next year, you know, if you're just getting it up and running. But the way that typical financial planning works is that you can have the funding, and it relates to the revenue you're going to deliver, you know, money in, money out, which is fine for BAU, but it's not appropriate to to entrepreneurship. You know, think about how VCs work. If VCs only funded startups that were delivering revenue, well, they wouldn't have anything in their portfolio because it's so rare. I mean, increasingly, you're seeing a bit more focus on that, but it's so rare. So that's one thing that I think leaders need to be very mindful of, is that reality that the funding model for innovation needs to be different. When I've set up innovation frameworks or run my own innovation team, we worked on metered funding, which means you only get what you ask for at the time when you need it. And the amount that you need is very low because you're trying to, you know, because I'm a practitioner of lean, we try to do the least possible work in order to gather the most possible evidence, or the greatest learnings, I should say. So I'm not asking for £1 million or £5 million. I'm asking for, well, I'm going to need £2,000 for the next 6 weeks. And then after that, we're going to have £5,000. And after that, we'll look at whether or not we're going to build the thing. You know, we're not, it's so there are, this is not like crystal ball finger in the air stuff. This is, you know, we'll ask for the money when we need it. And there's a probably, I don't know, 15 out of 16 opportunities will not deliver you revenue. And you model that into the funding. So you model for failure as well as success. And I think that's really important. You know, and I don't think it gets spoken about quite enough, which is that you need to build your financial model in such a way that there is an understanding and it is baked in that while you will be delivering revenue, you know, in 3, 4, 5 years time, you're not going to be delivering revenue from every pound that you spent along the way. Most of those pounds that you spent along the way will be going into projects that have been abandoned, but that focuses the remaining funds into those which you pursue. So that's one thing. A big objection to this kind of work is that it's always jam tomorrow, right? So, we've not delivered any revenue yet, but you know, it's just around the corner. And that I can totally see how that would be mega frustrating for leaders, for people in finance. You know, like it's not ideal. So the next part of the journey that I would want to take leaders on is to understand the alternative metrics that you can use, so innovation accounting metrics that you might use in order to demonstrate progress in the absence of revenue. So this might be things to do with churn rate. It might be things to do with validated learnings. It might be, you know, to do with acquisition. Like these are important metrics, leading indicators on the journey to success. Which, you know, I really believe that innovation like this in a corporate should be done openly and transparently. So this is all the good stuff that we'll be sharing, whether it seems like it's good news or bad news. And there isn't, you know, when it comes to sort of this empirical side of things, there is no such thing as bad news, really. It's either a piece of evidence that demonstrates that something is worth pursuing, which is great, or a piece of evidence which determines that something is not worth pursuing, which is also great because you're not going to keep on investing money in something that's a dud or time that's a dud. Bringing leaders on board with the idea of innovation accounting is another really important thing that I would stress. Josh, are you familiar with the phrase HIPPO?
No.
Okay, so it's an acronym. It stands for the highest paid person's opinion. and that is one of the biggest dangers or the biggest sort of impediments to innovation in corporates. That there's always some big wig with a big opinion about, oh, this is a really great idea, you should look at this, or this is a really terrible idea, you should stop doing that. And so that's the next part of the journey that I would want to take a leader on, which is to just less put some of those opinions in the box. Now, that's easier said than done. But what you can do about it is you can trump those opinions with data. You know, if a leader is saying, this is a really great idea, you should definitely pursue it, and you can come back to them 6 weeks later or 4 weeks later and say, you know, we've spoken to X number of customers, We've run this survey. We've gone out in the field. We've gone out the building. And here is the evidence that displays, you know, that that demonstrates that those assumptions are incorrect, that this is not a problem that customers are A, concerned about, B, willing to spend money on solving. And, you know, you, if I'm in a room with a leader and it's their opinion that something is worth looking at and it's my opinion that it's not, they're going to win. You know, their opinion will trump mine. But if I can take to them some data that empirically shows that this is not an opportunity that is viable, then mine trumps theirs. So suppressing the hippo, really important. The next thing I would say another thing that I'd say that relates to the hippo is the way that the RapidWorks process works. It's all about governance. And at each stage, so we begin by looking at whether there's a customer with a problem worth solving. Then we look at whether there's a solution worth providing. Then we look at a proof of concept. So can we deliver something that the customer will pay for that adds value? And then we look to whether we can scale that. Now, every juncture in that funnel, A, we're killing 50% of the opportunities. But B, the way we do that is we have a growth board. So that's our governance process. And the governance process, it has someone who is a leader who is bought into the process, and they only have to ask three questions. And those questions are, what do you know? How do you know it? And what next? Well, we're not so what they're listening to is they're listening to, what do we know? It's a body of evidence. It's a volume of data that's been gathered over a 6-8 week period that demonstrates, that validates or invalidates the assumptions held regarding the customer or the problem or the solutions and so on. And what we're not interested in at the growth board is hearing the person, the leader who's convening the growth board. We're not interested in hearing their opinions about whether this is a good idea. We're interested in, they need to hear the data. So that's why it's, what do you know and how do you know? What do you know? What is the body of evidence? How do you know it? How did you gather that? You know, what were the experiments that you ran in order to gather this data? And what next? It's a recommendation. It's a stop. It's a pivot. It's a continue. If it's continue, you know, do you need any additional funding, any resource, and so on? These are time bound. They're very clearly set at the beginning of a sprint. You set the date for your growth board. This is an opportunity for the person running the growth board to say, yeah, I've heard the evidence and it stacks up. Or I've heard the evidence and it seems a bit flimsy. You know, it's not enough. We need to understand this, this, and this. And this is very objective and it just removes subjectivity from the process. Anyway, that's like a practical example of how you can suppress the hippo. I talked already about the perception of innovation being inherently risky. And hopefully from how I've described this process, you can see that it isn't about doing risky things. Yes, there is room for appropriate risk-taking, otherwise it wouldn't be entrepreneurial. But this is about validating learnings in order to mitigate the risk. And I think the sooner that executives understand that innovation done well is about reducing rather than increasing risk, the more likely it is that we have their buy-in, that we have their sort of acceptance of this process and their support of it. Because really it comes down to the fact that it is more risky to make big bets. It is more risky to not use a robust framework for innovation. And the costs are going to be significantly higher compared to the revenues that you're likely to achieve. And that's not always the case. And different organizations have different appetites for risk. But on the whole, the opportunity cost of not running your own innovation within your big organization is much higher. You know, that because if you're just pursuing the status quo, that's fine for now. And, you know, your financial planning is great because you know you can put in X and you can get out Y. But 3-5 years time, you've been left behind, you know, because you haven't skated to where the puck is going. And so, that, you know, that's one more vital thing. Then the final thing I would want to say to an executive is about red tape, bureaucracy, corporate sludge. You know, this is the stuff that it just slows the pace of innovation. So I've, in my past corporate life, I've been guilty of sort of asking for forgiveness rather than permission. Now, that's not always appropriate. And it has led to a number of conversations over the years that I could have maybe avoided, but it was always in pursuit of outcomes, you know, of pace, of agility, of just getting shit done. And so I do stand by that kind of way of working, but I also think big organizations need to meet innovators halfway. So a big organization probably has all sorts of governance processes that relate to, you know, solution architecture and hosting environments and, you know, whether or not you can use ChatGPT or, you know, all these different rules that exist. And the reason they exist is because when corporates are operating at an enterprise level, it's absolutely necessary to have this stuff in place. It is completely crucial. However, if an innovation team is exploring the germ of an idea and they're just trying to build something to validate it, something tiny, and remember, I said 15 out of 16 of these opportunities are going to fail anyway, right? They're going to be stopped. So the likelihood is this germ of an idea that we're exploring won't go anywhere. So is it appropriate for the organization to make that innovator jump through every single one of the hoops that are built for a scaled operation just to prove out this one piece of evidence? And my opinion on that is no. And my opinion is that, you know, we're trying to be lean, we're trying to be minimal, trying to do the least possible to learn the thing. Now, obviously, we need a plan for when these things do succeed. How do we take it from this much looser operation to a, you know, a scaled enterprise level, secure, appropriately architected, appropriately hosted situation? But it's like a, you know, sledgehammer to crack a walnut. It's not appropriate. It's over engineered. And it's a blocker to fast, you know, de-risked, cheap innovation. So I'm a big advocate of, everyone talks about minimum viable products, which maybe it's not a conversation for now, but I'm a big advocate of minimum viable bureaucracy. So what is the least we can do in order to do what we need to do, whether that's from a legal perspective, a regulatory perspective, from an architecture perspective? You know, how do we bring those partners from within the business on side with us that they are enablers of us, not gatekeepers? How do we help them share in the outcomes we're trying to achieve? And how do we work with them to have the necessary amount of governance that is not a blocker, that is not just arbitrary red tape, in order to empower the innovation team to do what they do best?
Brilliant. There's so much to unpack there. And it's a really, really great insight to what it is that makes you tick as a leader, as well as a little bit more about your thought process and your sort of methodology. And as a final sort of question to round up this main body of questions before we go to a quickfire round, which we usually do. When you look around the industries that you work in, and obviously you work in a lot of different industries, like I say, you have a lot of different caps on, and the wider world, where do you see the opportunities to really reinvent the way things are done? It doesn't have to necessarily be in a corporate environment, but it can be...
I suppose there's two sides of it. My biggest passion is corporate innovation. And I think there are two different flavors of corporates. You've got your Googles and your Metas and the kind of corporates who've got it all sorted out. You know, they've come from a startup. They know what they're doing. They've got their processes, you know, Amazon's very famous for some of its processes that just really work, and they're homegrown, so they suit the organization, but they're entrepreneurial as well. The kind of corporates that I'm interested in is the other flavor of corporates that have just been a little bit left behind. They've been preoccupied with the way they've been doing things between 1960 and 2020. Then 2020, you've got the lockdown, then you've got the AI explosion, and the whole world has changed. And those are the sectors. And, you know, legal and insurance are both really great examples of those, that things have to change, and they have to change quickly. And there are a lot of challenges coming through in the legal tech or in the insure tech areas that are going to be eating their lunch if they're not careful. So that's one sort of one to watch, I suppose, in terms of the impact of this kind of stuff. And these big organizations are the ones where the most important thing is not the framework. It's not having read the books. It's none of this kind of stuff. It's about culture. It's about embedding it. It's about living and breathing this way of working. And it's a real change of the DNA of the way the organization runs to be more empirical, to be more data-led, to be more experimental. There are thousands of organizations in the UK alone that can benefit from going on this cultural journey to make the change that's necessary to do great innovation. Then on the startup side, you would be surprised the number of startups that haven't challenged the assumptions that they hold, you know, that haven't considered the difference, as I said at the beginning, between what they know and what they think they know. And if those assumptions relate to the customer, then the whole thing is built on sand. And so I think, you know, when you're in the entrepreneurial world and you've seen on LinkedIn, it's absolutely swarming with so-called serial entrepreneurs. You know, there's a reason why some of these entrepreneurs are serial entrepreneurs, because they're not considering the customer enough. And it means that they're not going to get anywhere with the opportunity that they're exploring. And often they find out too late. Now, VCs, they have a balanced approach to risk. So they're taking all sorts into their portfolio, and it's not necessarily that important to them if every single one of them is going to succeed. So the more that, you know, the more that this goes on, the startups not thinking enough about the customer, maybe having a bit of smoke blown in terms of their friends and family telling them what a brilliant idea it is, the more, you know, the more it perpetuates the startups that collapse. So the more that startups can do to really understand their customer and really understand what makes them tick, whether this is a solution they were paid for, whether it's something we can deliver that's feasible, that's commercially viable, you know, it's not just about having a brilliant idea and bringing in a great development team and building the thing. And that seems to be of a plague in the startup world, which I would be really keen to just say slow down, just say hold fire, don't start cutting code until you've answered these really, really important questions first.
Brilliant. That's a great insight. They're both sort of flip sides of the coin, and it's a really good spot to sort of move into some quick fire questions like I was talking about just earlier. Some range from the silly to the more serious, so hopefully they're going out well. So the first one is, could your friends explain what you do?
No.
what would you want them to say?
My parents have no idea what I do. My friends don't know what I do. A lot of people think I work in marketing, and I don't think I've worked in marketing since about 2007. One of my brothers thinks I work in advertising. I've never worked in advertising. My dad spent a while thinking I was a hairdresser. I don't know. I don't know what people think I do, and I don't really care.
That's fair enough. And over the past sort of half hour or so, you've given some really, really great advice. But what is the best advice that you yourself have ever been given?
I think being able to... I just did it. Being able to say, I don't know. If someone asks you a question and you don't know the answer, just say, I don't know. You know, it's the... I I certainly respect, I mean, obviously, if every answer is, I don't know, it's a bit useless, but don't blag it because it doesn't get you anywhere good.
Brilliant. And what is one thing that you could not live without?
A cat.
That's a good one. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most, how weird are you, Dan?
I think my colleagues would probably say 9 or 10, and I would say maybe 5 or 6. I think in your professional life, you're at work all day, every day. So I've always felt that it's very important to be able to be yourself, because, you know, there are so many people who are masking in one way or another in their professional life, especially in corporates, that, you know, just because you're a certain age or a certain job title, you need to be like super sensible all the time. And I don't buy into that. And I think by being able to be your true self at work, you're empowering those around you to be authentic as well. And I think that's a very uplifting thing for people.
I completely agree. Like there's an extent of how far you can take it, but yeah, to be 100% formal and 100% on all the time is a real detriment to sort of working, because not only are you putting a mask on, it's also surprising other people put a mask on, like you say. And that's a wonderful place to leave it, Dan. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a really great sort of half hour or so.
Thanks for having me.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.